The Guardian.
It's a Christmas miracle election, or a nightmare, depending on how you look at it. I'm Rowena Mason, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly. On Tuesday night, MPs voted by a large majority to call a snap general election for the 12th of December. This will be the first December poll since 1923, but there are members of all parties who are unsure that an election will break the deadlock on Brexit and yield the results they all so desperately desire. Now the battle commences. The Tories will campaign on the basis that they are the party that can get Brexit done, although we've heard that for a while now. And Labour is promising a second referendum and will try to turn the conversation onto ending austerity and protecting the NHS. They will both be challenged by the Lib Dems, promising to revoke Article 50, and the Brexit Party, pushing for a no-deal departure from the EU. So who will be victorious? What gameplay should we expect to see over the next 6 weeks? And how will the smaller parties affect their voting strategies? And with the chances of securing a second EU referendum dependent on this election, we look at what happened to the People's Vote campaign over the last few days. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. Ho, 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 merry general election. As we record, members of the House of Lords are debating the early parliamentary general election bill. But given there was a clear majority in the House of Commons last night, it seems almost certain the legislation will pass all of its stages by the end of today and the country will be going to the polls on December the 12th. To discuss what we can expect from the next 6 weeks, I'm joined by The Observer's Michael Savage, the journalist Ellie Mae O'Hagan and Mark Wallace, the executive editor of Conservative Home. Now, Michael, the timings of this aren't perfect for anyone, are they? Are voters going to be irritated with activists landing on their doorsteps at Christmas time?
I suspect we all know the answer to that one. But parties, the Lib Dems and others, Labour in the end, and obviously the Tories for a long time simply concluded that the only way to end the logjam was to shake things up and change the arithmetic in Parliament. I don't think voters will particularly welcome the decision, but here it is. And then the question comes to, you know, how is it going to be fought? What are the risks? There are risks for absolutely everyone, and part of the election is going to be who can reduce those risks the best.
And what about this idea that activists might not turn out in bad weather, that they'll be depressed by the dark evenings and won't want to campaign? Ellie, do you think that's a risk for either or both main parties?
Well, I mean, I think it's a risk for the Conservatives because their activists are all of a certain vintage and they don't have that many of them. But I mean, from what I've seen of Labour activists, they're absolutely psyched for an election in a way that I've actually found quite astonishing. I mean, we've seen that last night the Labour Party managed to raise £190,000 in just one evening, and then Momentum just announced before we started recording that they've doubled their fundraising target in half the time they were expecting. Everybody I know who is involved in the party in some way, either at a grassroots level or, you know, they work for it or they support it in some way, who would have been incredibly maudlin about an election even just a couple of weeks ago, they've sort of immediately caught election fever in quite a sincere way. So I think in the Labour Party, I don't think that's a problem at all.
Mark, what do you think about the timing of it? Do you think it's going to harm campaigning on the ground, or do you think this will actually be a campaign that's fought more over social media and on the airwaves?
Well, I think Ellie's right that morale is definitely high, actually, on both sides of this. We're going to see relatively unusually in British politics, a campaign in which both sides' troops are really up for having quite a vigorous campaign. There is a simple tactical difficulty, which is that while people often say that they are frustrated that they never hear from political parties, they also quite often don't really enjoy having political parties knock on their door, and that's particularly the case when it's dark, frankly. There's a lot of people. Less so, I think, activists wanting to go out in the dark and the cold. More actually, quite a lot of voters don't particularly like people knocking on their doors, particularly after the sun goes down. And it is something that actually it's quite common as an activist to choose to knock off canvassing when it gets dark, and the problem is obviously in December, that's pretty early.
And just onto the messaging, Michael. After the vote, Boris Johnson put out a tweet which included the hashtag Britain deserves better. Mm. He's obviously trying to draw a line under the last 9 years of the Conservatives being in power and having a policy of austerity. Do you think that he's going to be successful in this messaging on the NHS and schools and public services in distancing himself from what his own party have been doing for almost a decade?
Yeah, well, I think that's, I mean, it's partly about trying to deal with that, but I think frankly it's also about the sort of Brexit conundrum that has driven everyone insane, voters, politicians, journalists alike. And even today he was talking about next year, you know, 2020, let's not waste another year on Brexit. So I think that's part of it, is this quote-unquote get Brexit done message as well. I mean, the interesting thing is we're having a pre-Brexit election, and one of the huge things obviously is whether that election will be about Brexit or whether it's about something else. As we found it in 2017, it can start as one thing and end up as something else. I think almost for Boris Johnson, having a clear position on Brexit and a deal might actually help him. And actually, if it became about other things, that's almost more dangerous for him.
Ellie, do you think that Labour will be successful in moving the conversation onto public services and domestic agenda, where it's stronger on potentially than Brexit? Or do you think it doesn't matter necessarily what the focus of the election is going to be?
Oh, I definitely think it matters. And yes, I think Labour will probably manage to do that. I think, first of all, once the manifestos come out, I think that will reset the terms of the election to be about a bit more than Brexit, because all of a sudden we'll have these quite weighty documents about what the parties stand for. And secondly, I think, you know, Labour just has to keep reminding people, and I think most people do understand this anyway, and I think this is what we saw in 2017, that an MP, I mean, this phrase, bit corny, but it really applies this time, an MP is for life and not just for Christmas. You know, this is not just a de facto referendum on Brexit. This is about the direction of this country over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think most voters do understand that. I think what we saw in the EU elections is that people assumed it was an election that didn't really have, wasn't very consequential, didn't really matter. And because it was the EU elections, they saw it as a way of expressing an opinion on Brexit. I don't think the same holds for general elections. And actually, I've seen even today the most ardent critics of the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn, who are very enthusiastic Remainers, now saying that they will vote tactically to keep Tories out, even if that means voting Labour. And I think that's because there is an understanding that there are big things at stake here and that this is about more than just a referendum.
Mark, a big plank of Boris Johnson's strategy is around Brexit and the hope that the party can steal Labour seats in constituencies that predominantly voted for Leave in the north of England, in Wales. Do you think that's risking a rerun of 2017 and the assumption that traditional Labour voters will come over to the Conservative side?
You know, there's no Conservative activist, no Conservative member, no candidate or MP who's going to forget 2017 in a hurry. It was an extremely scarring experience, extremely rough campaign. There are a lot of self-inflicted wounds there. But there is a quite good fundamental reason why Conservative strategists keep coming back to this question of some kind of realignment. Yes, they would hope to hang on to their existing base, existing vote as much as possible while adding in new gains. But there is, frankly, a simple reality, which is that Brexit, along with some other factors, drives the idea that actually the Conservatives do need to be looking, if they're going to take gain seats anywhere, to gaining these kind of seats. There are some, of course, which are extremely close. There's some seats that were once perhaps relatively unthinkable Conservative territory are now in real target territory.
Now, another thing Boris Johnson's probably going to try and do in this election is sort of regain some of the mantle of supposed liberalism from when he was Mayor of London. But there's going to be some quite notable absences in the Conservative Party. Lots of the more centrist MPs, such as Ken Clark, and now most recently today, Amber Rudd, David Lidington, standing down. There's been a sort of clear out of the moderates almost. Michael, do you think that that sort of shift in what the Conservative Party is and the type of people who are standing for it is going to be significant at all?
Well, I mean, this is one of the really interesting things about whether we had a pre-Brexit or post-Brexit election, because actually strategically for the Conservative Party, it's a huge difference. Pre-Brexit, you would have a more sort of a caricature, but a more sort of vote leave Brexit-y campaign. Afterwards, you might be able to pivot to a more one nation, liberally Boris Johnson, Mayor of London type campaign. And obviously it presents a huge opportunity for the Liberal Democrats if the Conservative Party moved too far to the right. And of course, one of the problems when Boris Johnson goes after some of these Labour heartland seats is he is going to be vulnerable in some of the other seats to the Liberal Democrats. And that is one of the, you know, very difficult calculations that the party's going to face.
But 10 formerly ostracised Tories who had the whip withdrawn are back in. Mark, do you think it'll make a difference at all? And why leave the other 11 out in the cold, people like David Gawk?
Well, the first thing to note is that, of course, several of those who've regained the whip are regaining the whip as their kind of last experience as MPs. They're going to be retiring or leaving Parliament anyway, Ken Clark being a pretty good example. So there's still, in a certain sense, they're not sacrificing the idea of incoming new candidates and new blood into the party. That's still happening. The fact is, there simply was a calculation in that they had to say, well, you've gone against our whip on something we viewed as a confidence matter. That's why we withdrew the whip. We've set out some expectations in terms of what you're going to do in terms of supporting getting Brexit done that we'd like to see you do to get the whip back. You've either done that or you haven't. And so it is kind of tough love in some ways, but at the same time, it is quite notable. I think in the Conservative Party, there is at least some kind of route back and some kind of conditions for this. There doesn't seem to be any sign on the opposition benches of a kind of rapprochement with some of their former MPs.
Now, Ellie, we saw Jeremy Corbyn come out really hugely energetic after he had taken the decision to take the plunge and go for an election. He had a sort of glint in his eye that people hadn't maybe seen for some time. He's saying it's all to play for and Labour have got a strong chance of coming out on top. How do you rate the party's chances?
Great. Because I know that, like in any other circumstances, for a party to have the gap in the polls that it does, you might think that I was sort of living in cloud cuckoo land to say such a thing. But the fact is, Labour is a bit higher polling at the moment just than it was in 2017. And the Conservatives are much lower. And I think, you know, we're living in a very volatile political moment. And though I completely agree that most people in this country have Brexit fatigue, I don't think they have politics fatigue. I think this is a deeply political moment and where politics has once again become about the conflict of ideas, about the struggle between competing interests. There's a real choice now and people are engaged. Voter turnout went up at the last election. And none of us, including me, expected 2017 to happen. It did. Labour have come at this like a rabbit out of a trap. I just don't see how they don't have a real shot in this election.
A real shot at an overall majority or running a minority administration? What do you think's the most likely of those?
Well, the last election, I thought that Labour would be absolutely destroyed and would not come back for 20 years. My instinct tells me this time that minority government is the most likely, so therefore I think probably a majority. You know, I think the other thing that we need to remember is that the kind of policies that Labour are advocating were considered politically impossible for 20, 30 years. And actually, it turns out that they're deeply, deeply popular. I think the manifesto last year was the moment at which the campaign really turned around for Labour. And I expect this one to be even more all singing and all dancing than the last one. So I think there's everything to play for.
Michael, what do you think about Labour's chances? And is there a risk to Jeremy Corbyn that the Lib Dems are going to eat into some of its remaining voters?
Yeah, so if you look at a sort of, what do Labour need to sort of form a majority, however slim? You're talking about 80 seats, basically. So where are these 80 seats going to come from? That's going to be the challenge. So first of all, you have to hold on to these seats that Boris Johnson is going after. You probably have to make advances in Scotland. You have to make advances in some Conservative seats. And you have to fight off the Lib Dems. And he's absolutely right. We're entering an incredibly unstable election, and it would be mad now to sit here and say what you thought the result would be. I mean, especially if the Brexit Party come back, you're then into a sort of four-way split on the vote potentially. And you know, 2017, no one saw that coming. Can he pull off the same trick again? It might be harder, but I think it'd be a foolish person to say it's impossible now.
So talking about challenger parties who are snapping at the heels of the main ones, Mark, how worried are you about the Brexit Party eating into the Conservative vote?
Well, it's clearly a potential concern, in a sense, from what Michael's just said. Part of this election is going to be about which party leader can best hold together the coalition that their party previously had. Obviously, we're both in search of additional groups of voters they can add. But the Brexit Party is a clear risk. 60% or thereabouts of Tory party members voted for the Brexit Party in the EU election earlier this year. That's no, you know, plenty of traditional Tory voters did as well. And a lot of the potential target voters for Boris Johnson would have been quite sympathetic to Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party as well. The two elements that are going to be decisive are firstly whether they can get a differential split. So the signs in the polling so far is that the Brexit Party's falling vote has been more people switching to the Tories than switching back to Labour. So if you can get that, you can get to a point where some Brexit Party candidates can do more harm to Labour than Tories. The other question is where they stand. I understand there's a fierce debate inside the Brexit Party right now about who to oppose. Some Brexit Party candidates saying that where they live in the seats of Tory Brexiteers, they'll vote for them, but they might still stand against the Tories in marginal seats. Now, quite where that falls could make a huge difference.
And there's also the possibility that the SNP will really make a clean sweep in Scotland, almost potentially taking up to 13 Conservative seats there. Do you think that's going to really risk Boris Johnson's dreams of getting an overall majority?
Yeah, I think it's possible to underrate the level of concern there is in Scotland about the prospect of another independence referendum. I think it's possible that the SNP become overconfident they can actually turn out votes who are concerned, unionist voters, against them. But yes, you know, the more seats that the SNP gain north of the border, the harder the Conservatives have to work in England and Wales in order just to tread water and stay level.
And lots of the headlines this morning were about how Boris Johnson was calling this election in order to try and break the deadlock. Michael, what happens at the end of all this if nobody wins a majority and we come back with a hung parliament? What happens to Brexit and the country?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I have thought in my darker moments that by the end of this thing, we will have tried everything. So, you know, why not another election? Why not another referendum? Why not an election after that? I mean, you're absolutely right. The sort of glaring danger at the heart of all this is we all come back in mid-December in exactly the same position. I mean, and that is one of the factors that makes this so inherently dangerous. This is a gamble for Boris Johnson. Make no mistake about it. There's no certainties in this election and he knows it.
I think that's true, but I also think it's the case that Boris Johnson for some time has had no choice but to call an election eventually because the parliamentary maths means that he just can't govern, he can't pass anything. So an election was always inevitable.
Mark, do you think this was the right moment for it, though, given that some of his own party were pushing him to get through the withdrawal agreement bill? He could have had his Brexit deal through by October the 31st.
I'm with Ellie on this. The fact is that the Mayites, when Theresa May was clinging on to Downing Street, always said, well, you know, changing Prime Minister won't change anything because the arithmetic stays the same. Well, changing Prime Minister has changed a lot, not least it's reopened the withdrawal agreement, it's produced a new deal, it's changed the polls, but the ultimate sanction is if Parliament isn't recognised, it isn't really giving enough weight to the fact it's changed public opinion, it's changed opinion in Brussels, then an election has to come through to try to enforce that. That's the option the Prime Minister has.
Right, we'll leave it there for now. We will be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Now, over the next 6 weeks, MPs and journalists alike will spend a lot of time reading up on the latest polls in an attempt to hazard a guess as to how people will vote. But sometimes it's better to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. So what exactly do the electorate want? Last week, before a general election was confirmed, The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor, sat in on a focus group in the marginal constituency of Watford, with 16 people on both sides of the Leave Remain divide, and she found some unexpected opinions.
So, hello everyone. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. So, my name's Nick. I'm from a company called Britain Thinks. So we basically do this. We go up and down the country talking about lots of different things, lots of different topics.
So last Wednesday, I went to a community centre in Watford to go to a focus group that was run by the think tank Britain Thinks. They had 8 people who voted Leave in the 2016 referendum and 8 people who voted Remain. So it was to hear all about their political views and what they're making of Brexit at the moment.
I also had confused, scared and angry.
So the first question that both groups were asked was to write down 3 words that describe how you're feeling about Brexit at the moment.
Yes, so it was panicked, confused, divided. They were the 3 I chose. Panicked, I mean, well, it's clear and obvious, the panic in the country.
I spoke to one specific member of the Leave group, a guy called Tom, who's 25. He played a really big part in the focus group. He was very vocal in his views. He talked a lot about how he'd voted in 2016 for Leave, but I think he realised that possibly what he'd been sold at the time hasn't really come to fruition, that perhaps He was missold a vision of the future and how it could be.
In hindsight now, there was obviously a lot of information we were told that potentially swayed my vote at the time, which is not a great thing at all. But in terms of, to cite a couple of specific examples, discussions around TTIPs, of the trade agreement between the North America and Europe, to do with sort of US corporations being able to bypass our food safety laws, for example. And I don't know if you've ever seen a documentary on food production, mass food production in the US. It's not something I want to be eating. That was one of them. And I also didn't like, again, it comes down to whether how much of this information you were given is true. The idea of like a European army, for example, you know, if you're going to have an army together, which is basically going to be who makes the decisions is who funds the EU the most, when you have to go in their direction, I don't like the idea of that. Again, looking back now, would I change it? I wouldn't change what I voted. I would probably just have to do some digging to find out some actual reasons for wanting to do it.
I think a lot of people just want it to be over, whichever way it's going to go. They just fed up with this dilly-dallying and they just want something.
I also spoke to Tina. She's 64. She's a Remain voter in 2016 and she works in Watford and is a medical dispenser.
And we've just had information come out about shortage of medicines because a lot of people are complaining that we can't get certain medicines and that it's Brexit. Does the general public know that, you know, or have an idea that there's a plan for what happens if there's not the drugs around?
I'm going to read everything you've written for everyone after, but we're going to just focus in the interest of time on Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn. Does anyone want to shout out some words that they can start with?
So both groups were asked how they'd describe Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn. The Leave group was quite interesting. It seemed to be that some of the sheen had come off Boris Johnson. There were things that were said, like he'd put his neck on the line, and they're thinking that he's working hard and he was making some progress.
I must admit, I almost have to eat a slice of humble pie. I personally used to despise Johnson through stories I'd heard of him, and I still don't agree with a lot of his views, but to go in there in the state it is and take it on like he has and actually get somewhat of a step forward, I think is, I take my hat off to him for that. Whether I want to continue to, or I'll continue to agree with him more so in the future or not, I don't know.
But there was the idea that Boris Johnson had perhaps lost the trust of some of those really strong Leave voters and that he wasn't quite fulfilling everything that they'd imagined. Tina made an interesting point, which was, for all Boris Johnson can come across as a bit of a bumbling fool, this idea that you should write him off as simply a buffoon was actually a really bad thing to do. She actually thinks there's a lot more to Boris Johnson than essentially meets the eye.
I think he's cleverer than a lot of people think. You don't get to the top in politics by being a fool. In America, you can if you've got enough money. But in this country, no, you've got to have made some good, sound decisions. And that's why I think he was a bit deceptive in the fact that he played upon that.
Which of any do you think is kind of better place to kind of move us out of our current situation and more towards where we want to go?
When it came to Brexit and who might be able to sort that out, the Remain group pointed out that Boris Johnson seemed to be the better choice, and they did think that he had sides of his personality that were strong and showed leadership in a way that seemed to far outstrip any qualities that Jeremy Corbyn has.
So what should happen next? What should happen next? We've had, as you said, some progress, maybe. There's a deal that's been agreed in Parliament. What do people think should happen next?
Towards the end of the session, each group was asked what they'd like to see next in terms of the political timetable. And I was quite struck at how little enthusiasm there was for a general election. And that was from both the Leave and Remain side. Lots of people thought that the result would be the same. It wouldn't solve anything. Pretty much the parliamentary arithmetic would end up being the same and be really difficult to get legislation through again. It would be difficult to move forwards with Brexit.
Like I said at the time, it would cause utter carnage, quite frankly.
Tom's really against there being a general election anytime soon. He thought it would be carnage. For emphasis, he said it would be utter carnage when he spoke to us later on.
We can't go to the point now of where we are, where we feel like we're maybe going a step forward and then going back a fair few steps and having to decide, okay, who do we actually want to lead this lead us through this now. And I think it would only continue to add to the divide. And for me, I'm a people person. I like people getting on with each other. I like to have discussions with people. You know, if you try and have a conversation with someone on the tube in the morning now, you get looked at like you're some sort of creature. And I don't like that. I'd like to be together as one.
What I did find really interesting, though, also was the Remain group, who you would have thought wanted a second referendum. They weren't enthusiastic about that at all.
We can't keep having, you know, best of two, best of three.
So the idea, if we start down that road, like a second one, why not another one?
The last point here, general election, okay, people vote Conservative, okay, but we don't really want a Conservative, so we'll have a referendum to have another general election because we don't want the Conservatives in. You could do any, you know, you keep, how often can you keep repeating stuff?
Yeah. And Tina explained why she doesn't want a second referendum.
Because we didn't agree last time, and I can't see us coming to a decisive decision this time. We've still got half the country saying one thing and half the country saying another. Neither of us are happy whichever way. You know, the people who voted to leave will be thinking, well, you know, we voted 3 years ago. We went through all this, all that publicity and bump and that they were giving out then. So if we'd go back and do it again, it would just be rehashing.
Whereas the Leave group, three of the eight that I counted, actually thought that it might be okay and it might be a way of settling things once and for all, having another referendum, asking people what they feel about Brexit. In a way, that would be a kind of device to move the conversation on and to move Brexit on from this period of stalemate, which was clearly very depressing for the Leave voters who just wanted to get things sorted out. I spoke to Deborah Mattinson, who organised the focus groups through the think tank Britain Thinks. She was sat at the back of the room with me and she was finding it fascinating what both groups were saying. But she left the room and said to us that it was the bleakest focus group that she'd run for quite a long time.
The national mood is really extraordinary. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard it quite like this. We did a big mood of the nation piece this summer, and it was negative then, but I think it's literally got worse, and I wouldn't have imagined that that was possible. I think the other thing that's interesting is obviously how fed up they are with the Brexit process. They're very confused about what's happened. You know, we're listening to this focus group the day after the vote where the deal went through, but there was the delay, and they're very confused about what that means and kind of what's actually happened. They don't know, and they have absolutely no idea what the deal is, how it, what are the main components of it, what it means for the country, what it means for them, how it differs from Theresa May's deal. And they know that they're lacking that information and they feel bad about it and they feel a bit guilty and they also feel very cross with the entire political establishment for failing to navigate their way through.
Focus groups are so important, and we know that the Prime Minister's chief strategist, Dominic Cummings, is a big fan of a focus group. This is often where he gets really important phrases from or where he picks up key words that really resonate with voters. I mean, I'd go to a focus group every week if I could. It's just so important to hear the views of voters and to hear it from both sides. These people are yet to make up their mind of how they're going to vote in the next general election. And it was very negative and it was very difficult to hear. It was hardly an upbeat session, to be honest, by a long stretch. But you've got to know how people whose lives this is affecting really feel. So I think it was a really great thing to go along and listen to. And it certainly, as a political journalist, these things are invaluable in terms of informing how we write about politics.
That was Kate Proctor reporting from Watford. Thanks, Kate.
Now, while all this talk of a general election was happening, things were heating up over at the People's Vote campaign headquarters as well, but maybe not in a way that many of its staff and supporters would have wanted. Months of inside feuding culminated in the rather messy dismissal on Sunday night of two senior executives by Roland Rudd, who is chairman of Open Britain, one of the organisations that makes up the People's Vote campaign. Now, Michael, before the news broke that James McGrory, the director, and Tom Baldwin, the head of communications, had been sacked, you had spoken to insiders who called it a civil war, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I have to say, having spent a good week sort of trying to report some of this out, the thing that surprised me most is the campaign got anything done in the last 6 months, really. Such was the sort of factional infighting and warring that was going on. And, you know, before you talk about civil wars, you have to recognise this is a campaign that was on the very margins and now has the support of, you know, getting on for 300 MPs. So you have to take that on one side. On the other, there are absolutely huge battles going on now and have been. And they basically boil down to two things. There's a strategic split and a structural one. The structural one is Roland Rudd wants to set up a new organisation to take the whole thing forward. You know, could that be the vehicle for a Remain campaign if there was a second referendum? And then there are people against that idea who just want to restructure what there already is. That's people like Alistair Campbell and others. And then there's a sort of strategic split, and to shamelessly caricature it, on the one side, there are people who say, we've got to energise the base, this Remain feeling, we've got to get it up and running and, you know, help the realignment of politics that might get that over the line. And other people who say, we've got to be strategic about who are the maybe 10% of voters who will actually win a second referendum. Who are they? How do they get turned onto the Remain side? And those are the sort of boiled down arguments where the splits are. The net result has been pretty much civil war, as I say, in the piece for several months.
And Elliot, it doesn't spring huge confidence for anybody wanting to see a referendum, does it, to have all of this infighting behind the scenes? Do you think it's harmed the chances of there being another poll on Brexit?
No, but only because I think the election has now got in the way of that. And so I think the election will prove a more decisive factor in terms of whether we get a second referendum. You know, obviously, if the Conservatives win, we won't. If Labour wins, we will, because that's policy. If Roland Rudd, a multimillionaire who saw fit to give interviews about the Remain campaign from the ski slopes of Davos, decides that he's going to lead a second Remain campaign, I would just like to congratulate the Leavers now on their victory, which is definitely what will happen.
Yeah, and I think the thing to remember is that this isn't just a people's vote, so-called second referendum campaign. Institutionally, legally, and in terms of personnel, this is the continuity Remain campaign, actually is the rebadged Remain campaign. And in this chaos, this is not a new thing, some of this strategic indecision. This is a direct inheritance of a lot of what we saw during the referendum. It was a huge gift to those of us who were Leave campaigners, watching the Remain campaign somehow manage to overstructure itself. It's fascinating to see the leaks in the last couple of days of its own internal audit, comparing how People's Vote organised itself to how Vote Leave did it. And I think, ironically, they've got some insight into where they went wrong. They're just carrying on doing it.
And Michael, really, Ellie's right that the election will determine whether we have a second referendum or not. The importance of this battle is actually what happens to the future Remain campaign. This is really partly a row about data and control and who gets to run that campaign. Who do you see winning out over this?
That's the ultimate question. I think the reason you're seeing all this now is because people know full well this has reached an impasse. You need it all out in the open and let the thing fall where it may and sort that question out one way or the other. Clearly, any second referendum has to be wired around, you know, getting those extra people, the softest Leavers or the people who didn't quite vote Remain last time because for whatever reason they didn't vote. I mean, it's got to be structured around that. That's the only sensible outcome. And then there's a separate question about, as Ellie says, who is right to lead it? Is it, you know, people down the line from Davos? Obviously not. So there has to be a lot of thought now about who on earth should do it. Who can get this thing over the line a second time?
So the starry-eyed Remainiacs, as the Brexit campaign might caricature them, they shouldn't be the ones necessarily in charge of the...
Yeah, so this is the interesting thing. Before I said that division is a caricature, it is, because there's a lot of people say, look, you can do both. You know, to win a campaign, you need enthusiastic people going out campaigning, talking to people in the and where they work and all the rest of it. And then you need a sort of strategic campaign to win more than 50%. In reality, can you do both? Yes, but it needs to be a happy ship, and it well and truly isn't at the moment.
I think one of the really important factors in this is the fact that the Remain campaign in 2016 was basically a status quo campaign, which argued, stick with things as they are. If you deviate from that, things will be disastrous. And what they failed to acknowledge is that actually huge swathes of the British public were already feeling a version of that disaster in their daily lives and that they wanted change. Now, I agree that key figures in the People's Vote campaign, which Mark is right to say is a kind of repurposed version of the Remain campaign, do see that that was a failure. However, you know, I'm on the left. I know what happens when you're defeated. It leads to a period of grief and a period of not really being able to come to terms with the reality of the new politics around you. That's what we saw with the Labour Party in the 1980s. It's what we saw with the Conservative Party in the mid-90s. And I think we're seeing it with this mode of politics now in this era, which is that there's a certain type of politics that might be represented by Change UK and the Lib Dems and the Remain campaign, which is essentially economic liberalism and social liberalism mixed together, what we might call centrism, which is in decline. It is in decline all over Europe, is in decline in the US. And I think that a lot of these key figures are not able to accept that. I think they're really struggling with accepting that. And that is the reason why they are breaking down into infighting. They are a strategic mess, and they're unable to really engage with the political landscape as it is, because it's hard for them to accept that. And as I say, I'm a left winger. I know defeat. I know what that's like. But I think that is something that has to be reckoned with. And I think if there is to be a successful Remain campaign, it needs to move away from those people who have lots of institutional power but aren't able to understand the political landscape. And they need to pass on the baton to people that do. And that is their hope. But at the moment, I just don't think they'll do that. And I think it's a case of nostalgia, grief and ego that is causing them to hold on to this campaign.
Mark, if Jeremy Corbyn were to win this election or form a minority government with support of the SNP and or the Lib Dems, and the consequence of that were to be a second referendum, how ready are Brexiteers for that outcome?
Very ready, I think, for fighting a new referendum campaign if we must. I mean, the first thing is you have a strategically weird situation in which Jeremy Corbyn, as I understand it, as far as anybody understands Labour policy, is he'd then go to Brussels to renegotiate a new deal, potentially when the referendum comes on that negotiation's outcome, he might campaign against the deal which he's produced in order to possibly to remain, which is slightly confusing. But a lot of what Ellie's just said, there's huge lessons from the history of Euroscepticism in this for Remainers if they wanted to look for them, which is that you can have a kind of really very emotional, very grief-stricken, is precisely the right term, hardcore of supporters and activists and politicians who can really sustain a movement. That's exactly what happened to Euroscepticism. For through decades and decades of defeat, was sustained by people who really believed in that cause and felt very strongly about it. But those same people who can sustain you for a long time can also be quite difficult to actually get on the right page strategically to actually win. And that's what you saw in before the last referendum in the struggle between Vote Leave and the kind of Aaron Banks, Nigel Farage, so-called bad boys of Brexit. You had a distinction between what would make you feel good, kind of wish fulfillment campaigning, or what would actually win, would actually persuade voters. And that's precisely the risk that I think Remain faces, is that a lot of EU flag bearers are not going to get them over the line.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all of our guests, Ellie May O'Hagan, Mark Wallace, Michael Savage and Kate Proctor. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Romina Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.